So this is work that was actually done with Wojciech Zurek, who, as many may know, has been working on problems like this for many years now. My talk will be in three parts. The first part is more an inspiration than a foundation, which is a brief review of phenomenological time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau theory and its interesting prediction of spontaneous vortex formation, vorticity formation, in a sufficiently rapid second-order phase transition. Then we start again from scratch and do quantum kinetic theory, very much of the kind that Crispin has just been telling us all about, first in the linear regime, where we find actually remarkably good agreement with the Ginzburg-Landau theory, and then pushing it into the nonlinear regime in a two-mode toy model. And there we're able to expose some of the flaws in the Ginzburg-Landau theory, but actually we're still left with quite an encouraging picture. So let me begin by simply reciting one of the legends of our people, the story of the effective potential in the order parameter. So this is a simple theory. You have some order parameter, it's a complex number. In the disordered phase, it lives in a potential like this. It fluctuates around at the bottom. And the phase transition pushes up a bump in the middle. The order parameter rolls out to a non-zero radius, and this phase theta then becomes the characteristic quantity of the new ordered phase. Now, those nice little wells live in psi space. And there's a separate psi for every point in real space, so you can choose psi independently at different places in space. And what's really interesting is if, in fact, you consider a closed contour in space, and then the phase at all those points, represented by these sticks with blobs on the ends, can actually wind through several multiples of 2 pi as you go around the contour in space. A nicer picture to show the same concept, theorist graphics envy, we replace the winding of that phase by this wrapping of the ribbon, and that closed contour in space has been blown up into a ring. I'll actually be asking you to consider experiments really done in a toroidal trap, but you could also just consider that we have uniform condensate everywhere, and this just represents some arbitrary circle in space. So this gives you this topological picture. To remove that ribbon, you would have to somehow push it through the ring. But that would correspond to making the order parameter zero at some point, which is energetically unfavorable. So unless you can overcome that energy barrier, you are topologically at least metastable. The object that gets conserved, if you can't come across the barrier, is this winding number, which is simply the integral around the loop of the gradient of the phase, which gives you, in fact, the superfluid velocity. So this gives a configuration in which superfluid is flowing in that direction. Now, the interesting thing is if, in fact, you were in bulk and you had superfluid everywhere, there would have to be a point somewhere in the middle here where the phase would have to have all values simultaneously, so, in fact, the order parameter would have to vanish. So even though this is energetically unfavorable, you'd be stuck with this psi equals zero configuration because you can't get rid of it without paying a still higher price. And in fact, it's not a point, but a line, a vortex line. So this is just to say why we should be interested in these things, why they're nice. Because this is something that's come out of quantum field theory, which is supposed to be about particles and fields. But here we have something that is neither. It's not a field, it's a localized object. But it is not a particle, it's a line. It's non-local. Not only is it extended, but the reasons for it being stable are these topological non-local reasons. So this is sort of exotic and strange. It's kind of unexpected. It's a peculiar limit of quantum field theory. On the other hand, it actually crops up in a lot of places in physics. String theorists love these kinds of things. Also, cosmologists like to think about cosmic strings many megaparsecs long, which can perturb the course of galaxies. Because in retrospect, topological defects like this are just one of the basic things that quantum field theory can do. And it's nice to actually see them. In liquid helium, of course, they've been seen for a long time. This is, of course, wonderful. It's a little bit like watching a magician on TV, though. You know, he does wonderful things, but you know there's a lot of equipment there, so it's not quite so surprising. It would be very nice to see these things in a dilute gas, a weakly interacting system. This would be really getting eyeball to eyeball with one of the basic weirdnesses of quantum field theory. And in fact, we think that we can kind of add more coolness to it by making these, rather not making these by hand, but by simply letting nature make them for us, by doing a quench quickly enough and sort of nucleating these defects spontaneously. Why should we imagine that that would be possible? Let me very quickly review this phenomenological theory, which based on an idea originally suggested by Tom Kibble, Wojciech Zurek worked out this theory using this phenomenological model. So here you have an evolution equation for the order parameter, which has some fundamental parameter, phenomenological parameters in it, an interaction scale. We consider here only repulsive type interactions. Then there is this kind of response time scale, which is important. And then there is this object, which is, in fact, in our case at least, a chemical potential. It goes from negative to positive, and this is the phase transition. So from this we can extract an equilibration time, which involves this response time, and then 1 over mu, and a correlation length, which also is got mu underneath. Now, if we do a quench, what that means is we make mu depending on time. And in fact, we introduce now then a quench time scale. We don't necessarily have to do the whole quench linearly. It's just near the phase transition, t equals 0, it's linear with some time scale tau q. What this would mean is that the instantaneous equilibration time scale is like this, 1 over absolute value of t. And this is associated with what is called critical slowing down. The system is, as it gets closer and closer to the critical point, taking longer and longer to sort itself out and equilibrate. And Zurek's observation was to extract from this by simply saying, well, at what time is the equilibration time equal to the time between you and the phase transition? Get the picture that during a quench, you will have an initial period where you're in equilibrium, a final period where you're in equilibrium. In between, there has to be a non-equilibrium region around the phase transition itself. And the time scale he identifies is this geometric mean between the quench time and the response time. From this, you can extract some quantitative predictions. What you figure is that the phase, the order parameter, gets chosen independently in, roughly speaking, domains of the size given by the correlation length at the last time the system is in equilibrium. So you take the correlation length at that time minus t hat, and you end up with this object, which is a thermal de Broglie wavelength, assuming that the temperature is about the critical temperature all throughout this non-equilibrium region, times this interesting power of ratios of time scales. From this, you can then, with some further thought, extract a prediction that in bulk you expect to see a typical defect density, which scales in this way with tau q. This is a quantitative prediction which people have tried to test, in some cases successfully. If you have the toroidal trap sort of situation, you end up thinking of this phase as doing a random walk. You get a different power. You have this minus 1/8. Now, this is an interesting idea. What would happen if we considered this for a trapped alkali gas? Well, TCE is somewhere a little below microkelvin, and because of the way these things are cooled evaporatively, we're pretty much guaranteed that this 1/4 power of this ratio, if we figure tau naught is the scattering rate, is essentially of order 1, certainly not too much bigger. And from this you get that this correlation psi hat is only 100 nanometers. Now, this does not mean that you expect to see vortex lines lined up 100 nanometers apart by any means. However, I mean, this is sort of an extreme upper bound on how dense they can be. But the fact that this is not like a millimeter, but in fact is much smaller than the typical condensate clouds, says that we actually should be in the ballpark here. Okay, the question this raises is this time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau theory just a fantasy? It's based on macroscopic limit and systems very close to equilibrium. Here we've got a finite trap, finite number of atoms, and we're very far from equilibrium. So what we have to do is start again from scratch, trying to do something from first principles like quantum kinetic theory, and see whether the picture makes any sense at all. Let me just, Crispin has already told you about quantum kinetic theory, just let me give my pitch for this type of, this approach. If you knew all the two-point functions, you would know everything. But you have to coarse grain somehow, and so the usual approach that leads to hierarchies of endpoint functions and so on is at some point you restrict how many particles you want to consider. Restrict M and N. The alternative is instead to consider arbitrarily many particles but restrict the range of states that you're going to look at, the range of modes you're going to look at. And so this is the approach that we're following. As Crispin explained, it's kind of like quantum laser theory applied to atoms. So this is my version of some nicer slides by Crispin. We again have the picture of the reservoir band, the condensate band, You do a trace with the reservoir assumed to be in some grand canonical ensemble. You end up with a reduced density matrix for the condensate. And then this evolves under some master equation. So while we assume that the reservoir is always in equilibrium at some temperature and chemical potential, we allow the condensate to go out of equilibrium with it. Now, one can easily give an entire talk or several on deriving these master equations and why you should believe them. I will simply quote the result that one gets if we consider only the linear regime. That is, before there has been much condensation, before we have too many particles in any single mode, and we can sort of neglect coherent nonlinear interactions between these condensate modes. This ought to be good around TC, just at the onset of Bose condensation. And then you get a master equation if you have various modes, K, in the condensate band, which looks like this. The top term is the Hermitian term, and then the bottom term is changing the particle number. There's an overall scattering rate, actually, which may be K-dependent. We'll, in fact, assume that they're basically not K-dependent for the rest of my talk. This is just makes it a little more complicated. These gamma Ks can, of course, be computed. They're, in fact, always basically of the order of the Boltzmann scattering rate. And it's not important to look at the details of this. Just notice the way it has competition between beta mu and thermal factors beta Ek. Fortunately, since we're actually considering a quench where you start off in some thermal equilibrium and then start quenching, we can solve this in the linear regime with this kind of solution. So rho is this operator which includes many possible number states, and however, it's all determined by this mean n bar k. And that master equation then becomes this rate equation, very much like Crispin's, but I guess it's exactly the same, for this mean. But notice this mean, we're not assuming that this is a definite number of particles. The fluctuations in this are enormous. And in fact, the fluctuations in the particle number are on the order of the particle number. So indeed, what this does predict is that there will be many modes, all getting decent numbers of particles as you go through this phase transition. It's not just the lowest mode that is getting the particles. The fluctuations are large, and in fact, there could be a decent chance that one of the excited modes ends up with a lot more, by luck, at some stage. What happens then later is nonlinear effects will come in, and somebody will win, and the losers will be suppressed. I'll describe that a bit later in the toy model. Qualitatively, that's clear. So the question then is just to predict what are the probabilities of a mode having a large number of particles and actually winning the competition with the lowest mode. You can get that simply by solving this n bar. If your n bar is low, you're going to have one hell of a fluctuation to beat the lowest mode, which has a large n bar. In fact, the solution to this equation is very closely given by this. This thing is something which, for very early times, before the quench, is very small, and this leaves you with particle numbers of order 1. But after the quench, this thing is going to 1, and you get this inverse Gaussian growth. That, of course, then gets cut off. But you have this fairly well-defined turnover from small particle numbers to a great kick of explosive growth. And in fact, here we're recovering the critical slowing down behavior. Here is before the phase transition up to time zero in units of this quench time. And in fact, the actual quench is this tanch profile. Here would be the equilibrium number of particles for the lowest mode. And here are the curves that you actually follow under that equation for varying quench rates compared to the scattering rate. These x's mark this geometric mean that is 0x t hat turnover time. And while you can see that the turnover isn't exactly at t hat, it is on the scale of t hat. You move out of equilibrium at t equals minus a few t hat. Then on the other side, you get these nice sigmoid curves, which are qualitatively what's seen. Equilibrium is growing, and the system is catching up with equilibrium. Now, how it actually catches up is not in the equation I've shown you. That's not the point I'm making. Simply to note that after a while, and it is indeed on a few t hat timescales, the system gets into this inverse Gaussian growth and whips back to catch up with equilibrium. And as always happens when you try to rush things, defects occur. Now, that's for the lowest mode. The excited modes, because of their energy bias and the way that comes out in the master equation, what they essentially do is lag behind the lowest mode in time. And from this, it's easy to see that an upper bound on which modes have a decent chance of winning the competition for particles is that they can't lag by more than this time t hat. Because if they do, they will still be lagging well behind equilibrium with a few particles when the lowest mode has gone into this great kick of growth and is running away with lots of particles. So if you're lagging by more than t hat, you're dead. You will never win. So simply demanding that that lag time be less than t hat puts an upper limit on the energy of a mode, which involves the temperature and the same ratio of timescales. So this gives you exactly the same prediction as the Ginzburg-Landau theory. Now, what that then tells us is that we can have a reasonable fighting chance of an excited mode seeding the condensate, that is, having more particles than the lowest mode as condensation is just beginning. The question then is, will this mode actually survive into the nonlinear regime and emerge as a metastable state like a vortex? To do that, you need to go into the nonlinear regime with quantum kinetic theory. This is, in general, a really hard problem. Many of the approximations which Crispin was making to get some concrete results are just not going to be viable at all in this regime. So what I've been doing with Wojciech is nonlinear quantum kinetic theory for a toy model, where we only have two modes in the condensate band. Imagine one of them as being motionless, one of them as being some circulating state, whether we're in the toroidal geometry or in some compact trap. And the Hamiltonian we take for the condensate band itself is this very simplified form. So there's a bias energy E that tells you one mode is higher energy than the other, and then there are the interactions. We have this bosonic factor of 2. If these were distinguishable particles, this would be a 2, not a 4. And NC is the critical number for metastability. The number of total number of particles is greater than NC plus 1. Then the state with all the particles in mode 1 is actually a local minimum of the energy. So there's a threshold you have to get to in particle number before the excited state can become stable. This is actually a very special form. The two numbers are separately conserved. This is in fact the hard thing to generalize beyond. Perhaps later I'd be happy to talk to people about that. To compare this to experiment, even though, of course, it's very crude to have only two modes, for experiments, the important ratio of this energy bias over KBT is something on the order of 10 to the minus 2 for a sort of typical compact trap, and NC is something on the order of 100. In an experiment that Ted Hanch has proposed with a toroidal trap with a perimeter on the order of 100 microns, you can push this down to 10 to the minus 5 and this down to 1. So in that case, one ought to be able to actually see more than the lowest winding number. One ought to be able to see winding numbers up to maybe 100, it turns out. So what we then do is, for this model, that was just the condensate Hamiltonian. In addition, there is still the reservoir band. There are all the scattering operators. You do the derivation of the master equation, which Crispin outlined a bit. What you end up with is a master equation, which includes non-diagonal pieces. All we will care about here is the diagonal part, and it looks like this. By cunning notation, I've managed to fit it into two lines. I'll show you a bit later what these things are. Important are the rates. This is still just the Boltzmann scattering rate. And this is a different rate for scattering, which is this bouncing off the condensate, where you don't go into the condensate or kick things out of it. It turns out that it is going to be smaller than this gamma by something like this thermal factor. And the reason is simply that when most of the thermal particles are going quite fast, they're quite unlikely to strike a condensate particle without kicking it out. If you're going fast, it's hard to hit a slow guy and leave him slow. Here, in fact, are what these terms look like. Again, I'm not expecting photographic memory of this. Here you have the same sort of competition between mu, and this here is Crispin's condensate mu of n, given an explicit form because our model is so simple. And you can see that there is this saturation effect. You can also see that there's two changes between these, and this is this cutoff, that when somebody wins, the other guy loses. In green here, we have this peculiar term, which is the bouncing off, and here I just want to emphasize that it is doubly Bose-enhanced. So that's not actually such a hard master equation. One could throw it on a computer and grind it. I'm interested in getting some qualitative feeling for what it means. And so one thing you can do is take an approximation where the numbers become continuous. You convert that finite difference master equation into a partial differential equation. You do kind of a 1 over n expansion. The idea is that this is going to be good once the particles are a decent number, which is after t hat. So you just evolve the master equation, perhaps using linear approximations, and you get a distribution of particle numbers, a probability distribution. Then, after about t hat, you could start considering this kind of approximation to evolve trajectories from that initial ensemble. This is the sort of equation that you get. And what you find is that the first terms here are very much like the Ginzburg-Landau theory if you took psi squared to be like n. But then these terms represent this sort of hydrodynamic damping by the bouncing off. They're trying to kick the condensate down to the lowest energy level, or rather, to the nearest local minimum. Once you get above a threshold, these will actually favor the excited state. These terms are not Ginzburg-Landau at all. They're something that comes out of the quantum kinetic theory, and you would never have guessed from Ginzburg-Landau. So the first question you could ask about this is that systematic evolution actually the dominant feature of the master equation at any stage? This is, I think, a question that came up a bit earlier about whether the quantum kinetic regime and the systematic regime overlap. Simple way to address this, which we did, is if you go to the next order in 1 over n in approximating the master equation, you get a Fokker-Planck equation, which has diffusion. And if you have diffusion, you could start with an initial Gaussian, which is very narrow, and it would expand. And you can see how much the expansion goes compared to the systematic evolution. And these are sort of representative extremes. Here what you have is an energy gap or bias that gives you beta E about 10 to the minus 2, and your quench time scale is 40 times your scattering rate. And what you see is there's actually huge diffusion. In fact, diffusion is the main story here. And clearly, in this case, you are in the kind of thermal or diffusive barrier crossing regime. And Zurek's scenario about critical slowing down is still maybe relevant, but it's really dominated by this diffusive physics. However, because of the funny way that doubly Bose-enhanced guy goes, it turns out that even here, if you hug the axes enough, diffusion is much less. So even in this strongly diffusive regime, the systematic evolution does have something to say if you restrict yourself to a few sort of channels where diffusion is small. On the other hand, if you go to a smaller energy gap, 10 to the minus 3, and a faster quench, you can really make diffusion be quite small, and the systematic evolution is the most important thing after that very early time. Yes. These are N0 and N1, numbers of particles in the two modes. Okay, so having confirmed that there is a decent regime, at least, in which systematic evolution is important, compare that systematic evolution we got from quantum kinetic theory to the Ginzburg-Landau. What we find, of course, is that the Ginzburg-Landau is too generous. It overestimates the probability of getting to the metastable state. And in particular, the actual, this doubly Bose-enhanced dissipation is much better at killing off vorticity. You may start off with your seed circulating, but it can get damped down to being uncirculating much more effectively.
May I ask you, the Ginzburg-Landau is something different from Dostoevsky?
Yeah, insofar as it's real. Insofar as the time derivative is real rather than imaginary. It's tau naught psi dot instead of I psi dot. So it's actually changing the particle number.
It's the same.
except for the left-hand side, doesn't have the imaginary number. So the modulus does change instead of just this phase. With this model, with a simple Hamiltonian N0, N1, the Gross-Sedierski evolution really doesn't change anything. It doesn't change the particle number at all. Here's another plot, which shows, again, sort of representative extremes comparing in the solid lines that systematic evolution from quantum kinetic theory, and in the dotted lines was the time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau. And what you can see is that if you branch fast enough, like 10 times the scattering rate, they agree pretty well if the energy bias is also not too large. However, you do see some departure here. Ginzburg-Landau comes much closer to conserving vorticity, whereas that dissipation term will pull you away. All of these guys started off with more particles in the rotating state than the non-rotating state, and so vorticity would have been plus one or whatever it is for the rotating state. And yet this guy will eventually end up non-rotating, so vorticity is lost. On the other hand, if you increase the energy bias so that you're still only like 5% of KT, and you slow down your quench, so you're only about 100 times the scattering time, Ginzburg-Landau still thinks that you've got a chance. This here is the threshold for stability of the, this dashed line is the threshold for stability. Ginzburg-Landau thinks you can get across it, whereas the actual quantum kinetic theory says no way. However, you take that all into account, you consider initial ensembles that come from initially the master equation with no approximations except to neglect the nonlinear terms. That is not a systematic approximation, keeping all diffusion. And then once you've got a decent number of particles, you start looking at those trajectories. From this, you can estimate probabilities of ending up in the rotating state. And what we find is that if the beta E energy bias is about 10 to the minus 2, NC is about 100, sort of critical number to get stability, you should be able to get a vortex with probability on the order of 10%. Diffusion is a little bit hard to figure. If this were in fact 1%, I would not regard that as being different from this prediction. And it's only a crude toy model, so we simply have not worked very hard to solve exactly. We're just trying to get the order of magnitude. But that sounds bad if you have to run a big experiment that takes weeks. But if, like Wolfgang, has this simple, this condensate that can go, you can condense it and uncondense it 15 times in a row, 10% would be fine. You'd see it a few times. What we're actually a bit more optimistic about is, in fact, this bicycle tire toroidal trap, which Hensch has been thinking he can do. If you put this in, what we conclude is that we would expect to actually see a typical winding number of order 10, which works out to be a velocity of order a tenth of a millimeter per second. Now, for this system with the density, I believe the Landau limit on the velocity is about 1 millimeter per second, so we're well below that. However, even though we think this is typical with this non-equilibrium quench, if you have a final state with 10 to the 6 particles, the equilibrium probability of that kind of velocity, just as sort of Brownian motion, is like e to the minus 1,000. So you're way above equilibrium. So the conclusions, while still qualitative, are, I think, very intriguing. The time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau theory is definitely crude, but we have found that, in effect, it is at least wrong. That is, it is not completely irrelevant to this and just a fantasy. You need to correct it with more sophisticated physics, but it does give a qualitatively reasonable picture of what can happen. And if it underestimates the parameter ranges where you'll see something, at least you can throw in another order of magnitude and make it more accurate. Spontaneous topological defects should be observable in dilute gases. It's not clear whether it's happening yet. However, it seems like it could be. If extrapolation from our simple toy models would be valid, we would say it is. Certainly, it looks like something that one should be able to shoot for. To really answer this question from a theorist's point of view, requires doing a lot harder quantum kinetic theory. The simple toy model is really a very special case for various reasons. This gives a lot of challenges. We might end up with QK29 by the time this dust all settles on this. Hopefully we can do it a little bit sooner than that. So, thank you very much. Absolutely. I mean, this is something that definitely has to be done long before QK29, but you're quite right. I agree on all counts. We just haven't done this yet, but it has to be done just that way. Time-dependent Gross-Podievsky conserves particle numbers. We have to grow the particle number.
Why do you need that? Well, suppose you have quenched to some extension with large dissipation numbers.
The quench is what we are trying to the quench is what we are trying to understand.
Well, it's quite a trivial matter. You may describe quench in terms of kinetic equation, yes. But the most interesting will start just after the quench. And will be described in detail and most accurately by time-dependent Gross-Podievsky. If you have an access to a supercomputer, you must just realize that Gross-Podievsky and play, well, much serious to it.
In principle, I would agree with you that a big supercomputer and adding all the serious physics about scattering and dissipation to Gross-Podievsky would be the right way to go. You do need to deal with the large fluctuations in the early stages.
No. Everything will be described by Gross-Podievsky. Why do you have large occupation numbers?
The problem is, how do you get to large occupation numbers, and which state gets the large occupation numbers? By quench cooling, yes. This is the problem we're trying to solve. It's in fact predicting what states can get large particle numbers. Do you seriously expect to randomly have a macroscopic wave function with angular momentum 400? No, this state is very unlikely. You will not get that far in the quench.
Well, this is exactly what we will get a
sufficiently. Yes, the question is how quick is sufficiently quick, and is sufficiently quick actually attainable? Actually, that will not be good enough, it turns out.
Do you have something like E for the formation of water?
In this model, the critical temperature is just mu equals zero. I mean, it is non-equilibrium. Sorry? I mean, the critical point is just mu equals zero. This is non-equilibrium. So the reservoir has a well-defined mu all the time. And then it's just sort of a qualitative description of the behavior of the condensate that around mu equals zero it does something dramatic. That's interpretation.
I guess it really shouldn't surprise that time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau does not give terribly good results, especially for slow quenching. Because
right.
The basic physics, presumably, is that you tend to lock into one of your two wells, and then thermal fluctuations may take you over barrier and build.
For slow quench, yeah.
I mean, people who study vortices in superconductors are very used to using time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau with a noise term,
mm-hmm.
Which you don't have.
That's right.
I would suspect strongly that if you did use for a noise term in, the result you get would indeed be very, very powerful what you get for the slow quench.
But you need, yeah. If you have some motion, kinetic motion, you don't need to have any additional noise, because with a long kinetic, you inevitably would, in a rather large system, you would have vortices, and many of them. It's not one vortex.
But he's actually considering an annular geometry, where mm-hmm. the question is, do I get a circulating state or do I get
That's
a
right.
May I add a question? I think this was already referred to in the first question, but you said you can get a lot of vortices. Could you be explicit where the angular momentum comes from?
Yeah.
If I understand you correctly, it's not just the random angular momentum square root of n which is left over from the evaporative cooling.
It is and it isn't. It is just random fluctuations because you could sort of by luck get some angular momentum. However, the point is that once you get into this Bose-enhanced regime, that will grow, and more particles will go into that mode. Now, the question, of course, is angular momentum transport going to screw up this picture? Are you going to sort of deplete out of the thermal reservoir all the particles that are rotating the right way, and then will this picture shut off? This was the question that Peter asked. This is a real concern. I don't think it's an obvious killer, because angular momentum is a vector quantity. You can conserve it by throwing away negative angular momentum. And if you just end up ejecting the guys that are rotating the other way, the picture should be accurate. But Peter is right that this is something that has to be looked at. The other part, yeah, you're right. That is another scenario. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, James, again.
Yeah, this was Wojciech's idea that he had like 15 years ago. It really would be.